You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We're defending the world. We're like the policemen to the world. We're defending Japan as an example.
Will the president-elect be consistent with the rhetoric of the candidate? Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is hours from becoming the first foreign leader to find out in person. My guests Robin Lustig and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Boris Johnson's attempts to do business with the Italians.
Vabbè, tutti gli italiani sono benvenuti forgive me.
We'll also look at the possibility of Britain's House of Lords inserting a stick into the spokes of the wheels of the EU getaway car. And Canada's new national bird. Have the goose and the loon been cruelly overlooked because of their names? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist and broadcaster Robin Lustig and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both. And we will start with the ongoing attempts of the world's more orthodox leaders to grapple with the Amdram production of The Sopranos currently occurring between Trump Tower in New York and the White House in Washington, D.C. In a week in which we have learned that Australia's Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, was only able to reach the president-elect of the United States by getting his mobile number from the golfer Greg Norman, it seems that it will fall to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to take one for the team and be the first foreign head of government to actually meet with President-elect Donald Trump later today in New York. Robin, first of all, were you counselling Shinzo Abe on this one? What would you advise him? How should he approach this?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? I think the most difficult thing for anybody now who is meeting President-elect Trump is to work out whether or not to believe what he tells them. The reason I say that is that I was very struck by something that one of his supporters said the other day, which was that everybody had made the mistake during the campaign of taking Mr. Trump literally and believing every word he said. And he said, you shouldn't have done that. You just go with the message, go with the flow. And if you look at what Trump has said over the last months, he contradicts himself almost by the hour.
So often much faster than that, in fairness.
So he says at one point that he thinks there's no reason why Japan and South Korea, for example, shouldn't develop their own nuclear weapons. And then as soon as the New York Times reports that, he says, no, I never said that. So Mr. Abe is going to want to try, I suppose, and get some feel of what Mr. Trump actually believes and what he actually intends to do. There's a problem with that. I'm not at all sure that Mr. Trump himself knows.
We will come to that. Sebastian, echoing that point that Robin was just making, according to various reports, one of Shinzo Abe's advisers has been quoted as saying he'd been told we don't have to take each word that Trump said publicly literally. Now, on the one hand, that's some ground for reassurance because quite a lot of what Trump said while campaigning was quite mad. On the other hand, as Robin points out, if you don't know if you can take anything he says seriously, how do you approach this if you are Shinzo Abe or indeed anybody else?
Well, isn't the point of meetings like that in this period where, in this twilight period, so to speak, where you try to sniff the air and see? It's really a lot about personal chemistry, isn't it? More than about concrete policy proposals. Do I get on with this man? I think very interesting from Abe's point of view, just to gauge Trump's reaction to actually meeting someone who is in power, who has been in power for a while, who brings with him the natural authority of his office. And is Trump now able to make the transition to taking people of those ilk, his peers, seriously, or is he still on the campaign trail? I think that we, of course, the sad thing is we won't know because the Japanese won't tell us. But I think that's what this meeting can only be about. They won't talk about, well, you know, you've got to improve your military, or you've got to give us better access to your market. And I think that's for much later.
I think if I were Mr. Abe, what would really worry me, I would sit there and I would expect the president-elect to say, oh, everything's going to be great. We love the Japanese. The Americans and the Japanese, always great friends. Don't worry, it's going to be great. It's going to be terrific. Do you believe a word of that? Does he know what he's saying?
It's a very good impression, though, Robin.
Oh, thank you.
Have you been working on it?
Yeah, I've been working on it, yeah. terrific. It's going to be great. What do you believe? What does he mean? What does he know? All of these are unknown questions.
But just to follow that up, Robin, might there be a temptation or a tendency among actual experienced professional politicians to see Trump's inexperience, his naivety, call it what you will, as an opportunity?
Well, that's one of the things that slightly worries me, is that people less friendlily disposed to Mr. Trump, perhaps, than Mr. Abe, might take the view that Trump's total inexperience, even at the lowest level of politics, let alone at the highest level, gives them an opportunity to do what they like. I mean, can you imagine somebody like Putin or Erdogan of Turkey, let alone Xi Jinping of China? I mean, these are guys who kind of know their business. They've been around a long time. They are serious politicians. They're up against a man who's never done any politics in his life, and they're going to say, whoa, do we have an opportunity now?
But Andrew talked about an opportunity, and isn't it also an opportunity to offer a counsel, offer advice, you know, in a friendly way, saying, look, but we both know.
One does wonder how good at listening to advice he is.
Well, that's the interesting thing, you know. That's where I hesitate, I have to say, to think that someone could, you know, he's been around in business for a long time, and I know there have been dark patches and unpleasant situations, but there was success as well. You don't get that if you don't listen to advice.
One group of people he doesn't appear interested in listening to, or indeed dealing with, Sebastian, are, of course, our fellow journalists. There has been a certain amount of harumphing that on Tuesday night, having told the press that he was done for the evening and was going to bed, he went out without a press pool, which the president-elect by convention doesn't do. Is there any grounds for sympathy towards Trump here? Are the media over-entitled? Is the president-elect entitled to go out for a meal with his family if he feels like it?
No. Simple as that. Let's not beat about the bush. What we're talking about is a photographer in place in case of an assassination attempt. It's as simple as that.
Robin,
you need to have this man who, after all, still, whatever else we talk about, you know, the Chinese coming up fast, I know, the most important man in the world with nuclear weapons at his disposal, we want to see where he is. I have absolutely no sympathy with him.
I don't want to be rude about my American colleagues, but I did feel that the way in which they took umbrage made them look a little bit precious, to put it at its most mild. I mean, all the things they might want to complain about looking at Mr. Trump, the fact that he goes out for a meal without telling them comes pretty low down the list of his possible crimes.
And they're getting their retaliation in first.
Well, maybe,
quickly, aren't they?
Maybe. I mean, they know that he has no time for them. He knows that they have very little time for him. They're going to have to get used to that. They're going to have to find a way to work together. I don't suspect it's going to be very easy. He doesn't do things conventionally, does he?
He does not. And on that subject, as we go to air, the State Department and the Pentagon are both confirming that they still haven't heard from anyone on his transition team. He has, however, spoken to Nigel Farage and Piers Morgan. Let's move along now, because it is, of course, really only in America that a bumptious, unqualified self-promoter with unruly blonde hair could rise to high office simply because people found him amusing on television. Britain's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, meanwhile, has been failing to win friends friends or influence people among his opposite numbers from the UK's soon-to-be former EU partners. European foreign ministers are saying out loud with increasing volume that Britain's hopes of staying in the single market post-Brexit are somewhat fantastical. Meanwhile, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls has suggested that the entire EU project is in danger of collapse. Robin, on the subject of Boris Johnson first, are we witnessing proof of the theory that Theresa May set him up to fail?
Oh, it's so embarrassing. I mean, to be a Brit with that man as our foreign secretary, the face of the UK around the world, it just makes me want to curl up in a ball and hide away. The man is not serious. Just that little clip you played of him speaking quite good Italian for half of a sentence and then dissolving...
Half a sentence more than I could manage,
well,
in fairness.
Dissolving into nothing because he couldn't think of the Italian word for England, for goodness sake. I mean, you know, the man is not serious. And then he starts telling the Italians that they've got to let Britain have what it wants or they won't be able to export their Prosecco. I mean, they just can't believe it. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate. He's not exactly our version of Mr. Trump, but he's halfway there.
Sebastian, speaking on behalf of the entirety of continental Europe, how is Boris Johnson regarded across the water?
I think this Prosecco episode is very typical. He was clearly trying to make a joke. The Italian bloke, whether...
This was Carlo Calenda, the Minister for Economic Development.
Either by design or not, I don't know, chose to misunderstand and misinterpret that. That Johnson has to get used to the idea that people see in a foreign minister a serious politician. You cannot go on joking. It's great. It gets him laughter here in Britain, and but you want to have a serious person in that post.
There's such a fundamental problem of perception here. I mean, for continental European politicians to have this Brit coming along and treat the whole process of the UK's disengagement for the EU as it's some kind of jolly jape in a minor public school, it is insulting. Britain has created the biggest set of crises that the EU has faced. And there's this man bumbling around pretending it's all rather funny.
I should just say, if any old Etonians are listening, that was Robin Lustig describing it as a minor public school. Please address all complaints to him.
To be fair to Theresa May, I thought it was absolutely brilliant of her to not only get him into the cabinet. I would have given him health or something where he had, you know, a difficult task and was bound to fail. Foreign affairs, I thought, was very interesting because, first of all, he's out of the country, which is good for her. And secondly, he could then prove that he's a serious... And he must... Look, you know, he did rule London for 8 years. He got elected in a city which is really normally left-leaning. There is a great talent in there, but he's got to bottle up the stupid jokes and which he may think the continentals are too dumb to understand it, but he's got to learn they don't want to hear it. They want to hear serious politics.
I think in this particular instance, the Italian politician concerned, Carlo Calenda, understood it very well. The Prosecco reference, we should explain, was Boris Johnson made some sort of threat that if Britain was not permitted access to the single market, then British people would drink less Italian Prosecco, and rather walked into the retort that Britain, you know, well, from Carlo Calenda, he said, I'll sell less Prosecco to one country, you'll sell less fish and chips to 27. That, I don't know, Robin, what do you think? Does that have the quality of it as just one of those quotes that haunt somebody for the rest of their career? It is a belter from Mr. Calenda, it really is.
It was a very good riposte, and it was a real kind of knockdown blow, wasn't it? I hope...
It's his version of the story, may I remind you. Yeah, we don't know whether it actually happened.
Nonetheless,
but there we are.
It's a good gag.
Yes.
I would hope that it will give Boris Johnson pause and really encourage him to think. I mean, as Sebastian quite rightly has said, he has a serious job and he ought to do it seriously. There are many very difficult issues that, in theory, he is now responsible for dealing with. My fear is that, you know, Boris Johnson is a former journalist. He's a very beguiling writer. He's a great wordsmith. He's great fun to listen to. He has all the qualities of a good columnist and none of a good foreign secretary.
I mean, Steinmeier in Berlin can't stand him.
Steinmeier is
going to be our next federal president. So a person of tremendous influence and prestige. And you can, if he keeps going, you know, seriously, but if by the end of this year he hasn't changed his way, May should fire him.
Sebastian, we should look at what Manuel Valls has been saying, Prime Minister of France. He worries that the entire EU project is currently under threat. Is he right to be that worried?
Well, I've always thought that the EU will collapse if the euro collapses. He's now talking about the populist surge, and you know, we've got the Austrian presidential elections coming up early in December. We've got the referendum in Italy coming up, then elections in Holland, France and Germany next year. All extremely unpleasant, but I can't quite see the EU falling apart over that. I think it falls apart if northern countries lose the will to support financial laggards like Greece and Italy.
Robin, final thought on this. Angela Merkel has been semi-suggesting that there might be some room for movement on free movement, as it were, looking at whether welfare payments should be immediately available. Is it possible that this is the beginning of, or at least a manifestation of, France and Germany in particular realizing that, you know, that on the one hand, they're giving Britain a binary choice that you can have the single market and free movement, not one or the other. But are they starting to realize that maybe we have a choice between free movement and serious European countries being overrun by populists?
I think there is some deliberate misunderstanding of what Mrs. Merkel said. She said in terms that freedom of movement is an absolutely cardinal principle of the single market. What she then went on to say was that there might be an opportunity to look at the regime under which workers who move from one country to another then become entitled to benefits. That is not the same as saying that you're tinkering with freedom of movement. That's something to do with reforming welfare payments. I think there is a desperate, desperate need here in the UK for people to seize on anything that looks as if their wishes might be fulfilled. I don't see anything in what Mrs. Merkel said as indicating that that's the case.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Robin Lustig and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, is there actually something to be said for unelected politicians?
Monocle invites you to raise a glass of Glühwein at the annual Monocle Christmas Market. Please join us for this winter wonderland of a weekend, complete with warming treats from the Monocle Cafe, reindeer petting and an appearance from Monochan the Owl, all set to a cheery playlist. You can also try your hand at our ever-popular tombola and meet our VIP Santa Claus all the way from Rovaniemi. The 2016 Monocle Christmas Market on Saturday the 3rd and Sunday the 4th of December from 11 a.m. to 1700 at our Midori House HQ here in Marylebone. Find all the details at monocle.com. We ho ho, hope to see you there.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robin Lustig and Sebastian Borger. The late Duke of Westminster, one of Britain's wealthiest landowners, was once asked what advice he'd give any young person keen to emulate his success. His reply revealed much about how Britain is still governed. Make sure, he said, they have an ancestor who was a very close friend of William the Conqueror. Though fewer hereditary peers than previously warm the benches of the House of Lords, it remains an unelected body filled by various eminences and or veteran party hacks, and the Lords' role is about to be scrutinised again as it considers involving itself in legislation covering Britain's egress from the EU. Robin, the idea here is that Liberal Democrat peers in particular could force the government to reveal more about their negotiating plans, if indeed they actually have any. Is this overreach, though, if you're talking about an unelected quorum from a party which barely exists anymore in the House of Commons?
I have to be very honest about this. I'm a bit torn. I mean, the liberal in me says that's absurd in something that calls itself a democracy to have a parliamentary chamber which is entirely unelected. On the other hand, occasionally they do things that I rather like. And I find this puts me in rather a difficult position. I'm all in favour of the liberal Democrat peers doing what they say they want to do, even though I don't, in theory, think they ought to have the power to do it.
Sebastian, what do you think? Because Germany's upper house is a weird kind of hybrid of not being entirely elected and not entirely unelected, the Bundesrat.
It's not a hybrid at all. It's the representative of the current governments of the region, elected. So, you know, it's a very powerful second chamber. In that sense, it's very different from the House of Lords, because the House of Lords is a revising chamber. And let's not forget that the House of Commons often relies on the Lords to do the work for them. You know, they have shoddy laws going through the House of Commons on a three-line whip, and then they are quite happy that the Lords take a great careful look at it, all the specialists that sit there, and do their work for them. Whereas in Germany, you've got it's basically trying to the checks and balances between the federal government and the regions.
I keep asking myself though how we Brits would regard another country whose parliamentary system involved a chamber made up, I can't now remember how many hundreds and hundreds of peers there are.
There's about 800,
isn't it? Yeah. It's an absurd number of peers, all of whom are entitled to turn up, sign their name in a register and get a daily allowance of £300 or whatever it is. I mean, it's absurd.
Nice work if you can get it.
Well, precisely so. But it's not democratic, and it's not defensible in the modern age. There are different ways of having revising chambers. I don't think you should have two houses of parliament who are elected in exactly the same way. There'd be no point. But you could have them either elected by region or by party list or for a different period of time, all kinds of way of doing it. But the principle that should be elected by the voters of the country is absolutely sacrosanct.
Is there an argument for it, do you think, Sebastian? I guess the idea that you could, the case you could make is that these people are not beholden to what may be fleeting popular whim. They don't have to react to things because they're terrified of losing their jobs. They can take an impartial view of these things. Like Robin, I don't really know what I think of it myself.
I have to say I've come to like the House of Lords over the years that I've been here. I have to say it's you know, look at America where the two chambers are both elected by popular vote and are constantly nullifying each other and nothing gets done. I think it seems to me pretty clear in the British system that the House of Commons has overriding authority, that the Lords, all the Lords can do is prolong the process.
Especially since the introduction of the Parliament Act, which does allow the Commons to override the Lords if it absolutely insists, and I think probably quite rightly.
And by several conventions, which makes the unwritten British Constitution so very interesting, the Lords wouldn't normally force an issue unless, you know, we don't have to go through it, but it's, for example, if it's in the manifesto, they wouldn't take it to the wire. The experts, I think, are extremely important and very good. I would probably limit it to 15 years. I would throw people out at a certain age. I would cut it down to, I don't know, 500 or something. But the general principle, within the very odd constitution of the United Kingdom, seems to me to work.
Robin, Canada, which we will discuss in further detail shortly, also, I think I'm right in saying, has an unelected Senate. Does it cop perhaps less flack because it's not perceived as a wing of the aristocracy in the way that the Lords?
I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, yeah. But the principle of patronage I find particularly objectionable. The members of the House of Lords in London, largely, owe their position to either the Prime Minister of the day or some other leading party politician having recommended them for the job. quite often they're recommended for the job because they've paid rather a lot of money to the party in question. I mean, way back in the early 20th century, Lloyd George actually sold peerages across the table.
There's been plenty of suggestion that that practice endured until rather more recently.
Well, precisely so. I mean, it may be a bit more disguised, a bit more opaque, but it's still there. I just don't think it's defensible.
Okay, well, finally tonight, staying with Canada, and as we well know here at Monocle, having recently produced an entire issue devoted to Canada, it's not a country that lacks for national symbols. One thinks of the maple leaf, the moose, the beaver, and the hockey stick. Until very recently, until today, in fact, Canada lacked an officially designated national bird. That omission has now been rectified, and congratulations are in order to the grey jay. Sebastian, the grey jay was selected from five finalists. The others were the snowy owl, the Canada goose, the black-capped chickadee, and the loon. Has Canada chosen wisely?
I'm very impressed by your knowledge, Andrew. I'm sure it's...
I'll let you in on a secret, Sebastian. It's all written down here on a piece of paper.
I see. The myth is destroyed.
I don't even know. I can sort of envisage a can Canada goose. I can't quite envisage a loon, but it sounds very interesting. Maybe I would have chosen that. But anyway, I mean, it's all a bit of harmless fun, isn't it?
Well, I mean, would have there been an issue there in terms of branding, Robin, sort of ennobling the goose or the loon as your national bird? I mean, it's asking for trouble, isn't it?
I just can't get my head around this. I mean, what is the point of a national bird?
Well, everyone's got one, haven't they?
I didn't know.
What's England's?
Well, precisely.
The robin.
I would have hoped it was the robin, yes.
Actually, now I'm thinking of it. Does Australia have one? I'm letting everybody in on a secret.
It's in your coat of arms.
Probably is. The emu is in the coat of arms. That is true. Yeah. I would have favoured the kookaburra myself.
Same here, but it's in the coat of arms. We're so boring with our eagle. I mean, every other country has an eagle.
But doesn't Germany at least have one of the cool ones with two heads?
Yeah, very cool. No, that was the Habsburgs.
Albania has the two-headed eagle. It's on their flag. Unfortunately, if you look at it at a certain angle, it does have kind of an aspect of roadkill to it. It does look somewhat like
it. It is extraordinary how many countries...
If any Albanians are listening, that was Robin Lustig also saying about your flag. It's a very handsome flag.
It's amazing how many countries have decided that the national animal is the lion. There is something about the lion, you know, the king of the jungle and all that, that seems to suggest to countries
it is, of course, Britain's national animal. But you know, what option...
I thought the bulldog was ours.
I'm pretty sure it's the lion.
Is it the lion?
That's on your coat of arms.
As in along with the Lionheart and all that.
Along with a unicorn. But what else would Britain have had? I mean, you can't really go into the world with your national animals.
Well,
given what we've been talking about earlier, I
would suggest an ostrich with its head in the sand would probably be, at the moment at least, an appropriate national symbol. No?
Unfortunately, not a native. Sebastian, is there a German national animal other than the eagle?
I was thinking about that. The problem with Germany, again, of course, is that we've got different regions having different animals. So the Lower Saxonians have the horse in their coat of arms, for example.
Any particular sort of horse, or just the horse?
I think it's a white horse, but I'm not entirely sure.
The one national bird that really got me, Mauritius's national bird,
is the dodo.
The dodo.
Dodo, yeah.
Extinct. Mm. Why would you choose an extinct bird to be your national symbol?
Why would you have the unicorn in your coat of arms?
There's something vaguely magical about a unicorn.
I see, okay.
Of course, there is the peculiar case of New Zealand, who for obvious reasons can't put their national bird on the tail fins of their national airline, because their national bird can't actually fly or anything.
That would be embarrassing.
A Kiwi's not really the kind of the brand identity that an airline wants to associate itself with.
I don't get symbols.
You can hear the Australian smirking at the...
Yeah, and again, for any of our New
Smaller neighbour.
Listeners, that was Andrew Muller.
For any of our New Zealand listeners in New Zealand, that was very definitely Robin Lustig on that occasion. And on that note, with Robin now having managed to upset absolutely everybody, we will have to end it there. Robin Lustig and Sebastian Borger, thank you for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sacco and Daphne Karnesis. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next at 1900, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And I'll have more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.